Mercy Spirituality Center presents Muffin Talk with Beate.
Kia ora and welcome to Muffin Talk. Muffin Talk is brought to you by the Mercy Spirituality Center in Epsom. We are a center for retreats, spiritual guidance, Christian meditation and personal development. Once a week, I invite a visitor to join me in the studio to talk about our center, our programs, the Mercy World, or about social justice. As we are celebrating 50 years of the document Nostra Aetate, a declaration made at the end of Vatican II on the relation of the Catholic Church to non-Christians, and especially Jews, I have invited two guests into the studio, both Jewish, Rabbi Fred Morgan.
And I'm Joan Lardner-Rivlin from Radio Shalom, the program for the Jewish community. And this is a first. We are having an interfaith program in honor of Rabbi Fred, who has spent many years in promoting interfaith. Perhaps, Beate, you can tell us a little more about the rabbi.
Well, Rabbi Fred Morgan served as rabbi in a congregation south of London before migrating to Australia 17 years ago, where he took up the position of senior rabbi at Temple Beth Israel, Melbourne. Rabbi Fred has been very active in interfaith relations for most of his working life and currently serves as professorial fellow at the Australian Catholic University in the area of Jewish-Christian relations. He has been invited by the New Zealand Catholic Bishops Committee for Interfaith Relations at the occasion of celebrating 50 years of Nostra Aetate, the Declaration on the Relation of the Catholic Church to Non-Christian Religions, which was proclaimed at the Second Vatican Council. Rabbi Fred, you have been specializing on Nostra Aetate. How did you get involved in a Catholic Church document?
Yes, a lot of people ask that question. They find it very odd that a good Jewish boy has somehow gotten involved with the church in that way. There are lots of paths that lead into the same destination, but the story that I like to tell is how I was speaking on the topic of Jewish-Christian relations in the Philippines earlier this year, and my wife heard from the Jewish Community Council of Victoria that they were putting on a dinner together with the Catholic community in Melbourne, and they needed someone to speak about Nostra Aetate, so she volunteered me, and that's how I ended up doing this. But actually, that's not the complete story. I've been interested in Nostra Aetate really through my work at the Australian Catholic University. The ACU brought me onto their staff in order to promote a broader understanding of Judaism among the colleagues there, the academics who work in the program. And I don't think that it's possible, really, for a Jew to communicate with a Catholic audience without knowing something about Nostra Aetate.
But maybe you can tell us a little bit more about Nostra Aetate, what it is about.
Sure. Nostra Aetate is one of the documents that came out of the Second Vatican Council in the early 1960s. And as you mentioned, Beate, this is the 50th anniversary of the publication, so it was published in 1965. It's the Church's declaration on its relationship with non-Christian religions. And that includes a broad range of religions that are mentioned by name, Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism. But the Jewish religion has a special place of importance both in that document and in the work of the Catholic Church. So a whole section of Nostra Aetate, which means in our time, was devoted to Jewish Catholic, really, relations. It's section 4. It's actually quite a brief document in total, remarkably brief, I think, for the impact, potentially, that it has on the relationship between the Jewish and the Catholic community.
Can you explain a bit how you came to be invited onto the
The Catholic
Yes, I can understand that they wish to know more, but they didn't have to employ you.
No, you're right. They didn't. I'd never thought about it that way before. I at the time, the faculty of theology and philosophy of the university was headed by a very visionary dean. She's subsequently retired. But I think she felt the importance of having people who actually practice other religions on the staff. Up till then, they'd had a number of Catholics who were interested in Buddhism or Hinduism, who could speak about those religions quite knowledgeably. But it's different speaking about a religion that's not your own faith, no matter how much of it you've absorbed into yourself along the way, and actually speaking to your own faith and from within that tradition. The university had hired an Islamic scholar, so this wasn't the first appointment that they'd made of this type, but I think the dean felt that Judaism is of such significance to the development of Christianity and to the Christian understanding of Jesus and his life and what it should mean to people, that it was very important to have a Jewish person on. And I know that they'd spent some time looking around at the various options. I'm very pleased that in the end they decided to invite me to take it up. I really enjoyed it, too.
And what about you led them to choose you? Why were you the chosen one?
I was the chosen one. Because I'm Jewish. Because in my prior to becoming a rabbi, I'd had a deep involvement in religious studies. I was actually a lecturer at Bristol University in the United Kingdom in religious studies, and particularly in the religions of India, Hinduism and Buddhism. And then I decided to recover or re-explore my Jewish roots. So I went to Rabbinic Seminary to do that in London at the Leo Beck College. And I think having that broad range of interests and an understanding of what it means to study someone else's religion and how that impacts on oneself was of value. Also, I'd been involved with the Council of Christians and Jews, both in England and in Australia, for my entire career.
So your horizon had been opened already?
I think so, yes. And we used to ask quite difficult questions about what it is that we were doing and how we want to pursue it. And I think all that fed into a sense which the dean must have picked up, that I was ready to actually engage with Catholic scholars. And there are some remarkable scholars at the Australian Catholic mm-hmm. University. And I find our conversations quite interesting because they will often ask me for information about rabbinic Judaism and what the rabbis said about different topics, things like that.
Can you say something brief about the rabbinic Judaism? Because that's an expression that we hear often from rabbis, but many Catholics don't know about.
Yes, absolutely right. The other night I was speaking to some seminarians here in Auckland, and I think even they were a bit confused about what I meant. But basically, I see it this way, that up until the period of the Greek hegemony or domination in ancient Israel, that's the final centuries preceding the coming of Jesus, up until that time, Judaism had focused on the temple in Jerusalem, sacrificial rite. It was dominant both politically as well as religiously in that part of the world, in Judea. But from that period, society went into a terrible malaise. The governmental structure was very corrupt, and I think there were many different movements within that, looking to the future and wondering how the future would present itself. Now, out of that period, which lasted a couple of hundred years, of real social unrest and disease, a number of different movements sort of presented themselves as possible scenarios for the future. One of them, of course, was ultimately was Christianity through the life of Jesus. Another was the Pharisaic tradition. A third was the Sadducean tradition. The Essenes were another group. So there are lots of different groups. We don't have complete records of them. But it's really out of the Pharisees that rabbinic Judaism seems to have developed. And their understanding was that the temple in Jerusalem was at threat. It was under, a corrupt governance. And they felt it was important to develop an understanding of Judaism that would enable Jewish people to practice their religion even if they're not focused on the temple itself. In other words, a portable religion. That's what it was called, the portable religion.
Well, the temple had been destroyed.
Well, the temple was ultimately destroyed by the Romans in the year 70 of the what we call the common era or the Christian era. And it was good that the Pharisees had put this framework in place because it enabled Jewish people to reorientate themselves away from the temple and to the Torah. The Torah, in one sense, is the five books of Moses, the first five books of the Bible, but in another sense, it's Jewish tradition and teaching. So it's what enables Judaism to stay alive. Living a life of Torah means living a Jewish life. And of course, the thing about the Torah is it's portable. It can be carried from place to place.
Some of them are very heavy.
They may be heavy, but if you have a good memory, you can memorize the whole thing and carry it in your head, as they did in ancient days, of course. But it enabled Judaism to survive even after the destruction of the temple and into a diaspora or a dispersion across the Roman world. That's eventually what happened, of course. So rabbinic Judaism is the Judaism that was developed distinctive from the temple, which Jewish people could practice then wherever they lived in the world and still can practice today wherever we live in the world. And though we have a home now, reestablished, the state of Israel, we don't have a temple still. So this is the form of Judaism that's practiced. It does not require sacrifice, so we never sacrifice as part of our custom or our religious lifestyle. There are no altars in synagogues. We don't have an active priesthood any longer. All of this you find in Christianity, which does have a spiritualized form of sacrifice, but not in Judaism.
Your description of a very short history.
A very long history in a very few words. Yes.
In a very short time, but you've traveled extensively. Was that all in for interfaith relationships?
No, not at all. I've traveled for Jewish reasons, and as well as for interfaith reasons. So, earlier on in my career, I spent quite a lot of time working in Budapest in Hungary, developing a Jewish community there, mm-hmm. communal life. That was after the end of communism, mm-hmm. just a few years later. Young Jews, people in their 20s, let's say, had suddenly discovered that they were Jewish. They really hadn't been aware of that before, and they wanted to explore what that means. So I went over and worked with them. I did that for quite a while.
Oh, exciting.
Yes, it was. Very. I made about 15 trips from London to Budapest over that period, and then also one while I was in Melbourne. And encouraged one person there to become a rabbi, so she's now a rabbi in Budapest as a result of that.
Progressive Judaism.
This was all done through progressive Judaism. Mm.
So you have female rabbis in the progressive Judaism, but not in Orthodox?
We do indeed, yes. So the Jewish community often sees itself as being Orthodox or non-Orthodox, but that's a very poor description, because there are many ways of being Orthodox and there are many ways of being non-Orthodox, and there are many Jews who are not affiliated at all. they're still Jewish, but you see, because being Jewish is a kind of an ethnic or a cultural identity as well as a religious identity, you can be a secular Jew or an atheist Jew, if you wish.
I don't quite understand that.
Well, you can. I mean, if you still take the culture very seriously and you identify with that, no one in the Jewish community would say you're not Jewish. So that's sufficient.
And what about the convert?
People who convert are looking for a religious lifestyle. And the only Jewish organizations that perform conversions are the religious ones. So they could be Orthodox or they could be progressive or non-Orthodox. But you won't find people converting to atheistic Judaism. And I guess possibly the reason for that is because, say, you're a culinary Jew or a gastronomic Jew. Anyone can enjoy gefilte fish or, you know, latkes, potato pancakes. You don't have to be Jewish to do
meals,
that.
So these are all meals, gefilte fish.
Yeah,
it's like it's
food.
German. It's fish, but it's filled.
It's mixed. Yeah, filled fish. So these are all typical Jewish dishes. Anyone can enjoy them without having to be Jewish. But you can't really lead a life of Torah and still think of yourself as something other than Jewish. I think if you're leading a life of Torah, you'll want to do that within a community. And the community is the Jewish community. So we do have people who convert, not that many because we don't encourage conversion. We feel that the original Jewish attitude towards interfaith is, in the modern period, is be the best of whatever you are. You know, if you're a Christian, be a good Christian. Don't worry about becoming something else. If you're a Muslim, be a good Muslim. And that way we'll all get on just fine. You know, you do your thing, I'll do my thing.
Now I understand why they chose you for the
Rabbi, when was the first interaction then between Jews and Christians? Like, there's been misunderstandings from very early times. When did they first more or less?
Well, of course, that's a great question. And the earliest followers of Jesus, as Jesus himself, were Jewish. So there was no division then. Jesus was just taking teachings, many of which he shared, by the way, with the Pharisees.
Another rabbi.
Well, not a rabbi in the technical sense, because rabbi means someone in the Pharisaic tradition, as I am, for example. That's what we mean by rabbinic. But he was a learned man in his own way, or he had his own teaching. He was a holy man, I suppose you might say, a charismatic figure. Some would say he was quite political. You know, he knew what he was doing in rebelling against the Romans, but doing it in the way of a Gandhi or a Martin Luther King, who knows, you know, peaceful, nonviolent, non-cooperation sort of thing. But whatever it was, he had his own way of doing it. His followers identified as Jews, and some of them remained very strongly Jewish to the end of their lives. For example, James and Peter were both, practicing Jews to the end of their lives. It was really when Paul, who was also, of course, a Pharisee, opened this new group up to Gentile worshipers, that things began to move in a new direction. And when you have a great influx of Gentiles into the early community, not yet a church, I guess, but a community, and they were allowed to come in without circumcision, without following the dietary laws, in other words, without keeping the rules that that Pharisaic Judaism was beginning to develop for this exilic kind of Judaism.
So at that time they were developing them still.
Everybody was just developing. The rabbinic Judaism was just developing, just as Christian Judaism was just developing. But once you have this influx of Gentiles,
and who, Gentiles was people with no religion,
or people from Greek, normally from Greek background,
right?
Yeah, Yeah, because the Greeks were, some of the Greeks were very interested in Judaism. And when they heard they could take on the best, what they saw as the best of Judaism without the ritual requirements which would set them apart from other Greeks, then they found this very, very attractive. And Paul, if I can put it this way, was a great PR man. He was very good at public relations. He knew how to attract people into the now growing church. And as a result, this movement took on a character of its own, an identity of its own. And that's when Christianity develops, distinct from Judaism. But it was really the failure of a Jewish revolt against the Romans in the year 135 that I think put the seal on that. Because after that, Jewish people were not allowed by the Romans back into Jerusalem, but Gentiles were. So all the bishops from then on, all the Jerusalem bishops, were Gentiles. And that really split the communities, I think.
So it's a political reason, though?
As much political as anything else, I think, yeah.
You brought a beautiful picture with you about the synagogue and ecclesia in our time. Can you say something about this picture, please?
Sure, of course. This picture is advertising some talks that I've given here in Auckland, in Wellington, and in Dunedin on the 50th anniversary of Nostra Aetate from a Jewish perspective. Now, the Nostra Aetate was quite revolutionary.
Why?
It totally redefined the relationship mm-hmm. between the Catholic Church and the Jewish people. Mm-hmm. It acknowledged the Jewishness of Jesus and taught Catholics that they should learn the Old Testament if they really want to understand the New Testament. It also declared antisemitism effectively. It declared it to be a sin anywhere, anytime. So any attacks on Jewish people would be sinful in the teaching of the church. This, believe it or not, this was new 50 years ago. And it also allowed for the possibility that Judaism contains the truth quite independently of the teachings of Jesus. And that was truly revolutionary. And that's what this picture is about. In the medieval cathedrals in Europe, and I hope people will get a chance sometime to visit some of them, Amiens and the other great cathedrals, they often portray church and synagogue. The synagogue was blindfolded, and the church held a sword as a church triumphant, two women. In this new sculpture, which is done by a Jewish man, Joshua Kaufman, but it was commissioned by a Catholic university in Philadelphia, the two women are seated next to one another, and they're each holding a book. One is holding a book, the other a scroll, and they are looking over one another's shoulders at the different books that they hold. One, clearly the Torah, the other the New Testament. And it shows a mutuality of learning and understanding, which I think is really the essence of interfaith dialogue today.
And it's a woman holding the Torah.
Yes. Indeed it is, because in the medieval sculptures, synagogue was portrayed as a woman. That's a female.
And ecclesia also.
And ecclesia also.
So you've been interviewed now today by two women, by a Jewish woman and a Catholic woman.
And proud to be here with you.
Thank you very much, Rabbi.
Rabbi, can you tell me what's the object of interfaith relationships? The thing that you're doing.
Yes, that's an excellent question.
You've got 3 minutes to answer it.
Sure. I'll try to be very brief, but I think I can. I believe that the purpose in interfaith is to be able to listen to the other person without having to deny them or confirm them, just allowing them to be who they are, to respect their faith as another human being, to be curious about how it is that their faith motivates them and helps them to live a life, a fulfilling life, a meaningful life. And finally, it's a means by which we can reflect on our own faith journey in the light of someone else who's different. And I find that the most valuable at all, because Christians also often present me with pictures, and I have to look at my own life picture and say, well, how did I come to be the way I am? Why am I not them? And that's very helpful to me in understanding better who I am. So the aim is certainly not to convert anyone. It's to respect the other and then oneself.
Thank you very much, Rabbi.
Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure. Thank you both.
And to our listeners, what is coming up in our Mercy Spirituality Center? We have some events that are not in our program booklet. On Saturday, the 17th of October, David Crawley will facilitate a retreat day for men. And on the evening of the 21st of October, Rabbi Brent Gutman will tell us more about the origins of the Hebrew and Gregorian calendars. For all our events at the center, please register with us per phone at Auckland 09-638-6238 or via our website www.mercyspiritualitycenter.org.nz. And if you want to give any feedback on my interviews, please contact me at muffintalk840@gmail.com. If you miss any of our programs, please check out the website www.planetaudio.org.nz/muffintalk. I wish you all a good Friday and a blessed week ahead. Thank you.